This is ContraZoom, where we go back and forth about film. I'm your host, Dakota Arsenault. Today, we are bringing you a bonus episode outside of our usual release format. From September 29th to October 15th, the 61st edition of the New York Film Festival ran. If you regularly check ContraZoomPod.com, which you absolutely should have bookmarked, Paulo Bautista, host of the Oscars Death Race podcast, has been our man on the ground there. He wrote reviews for several movies that you can see on our site, and if you miss them, he recaps them today with his instant reactions that he recorded after seeing the films. Once again, thank you to Paulo and enjoy this bonus episode. We'll be back next week with our regular full-length shows.
Hey Dakota, hey ContraZoom Pod listeners, this is Paulo from the Oscars Death Race podcast. It's about 2:18 p.m. On Saturday, October 7th. I'm in a Chipotle, a couple blocks away from the Lincoln Center. This is going to be my first screening for the New York Film Festival 2023, the 61st edition. My first time actually being at the festival. My schedule for the upcoming days is tonight. Today at 2:45, I'm going to be watching Evil Does Not Exist by Ryusuke Hamaguchi. Around noon on Monday the 9th, I'm going to go ahead and watch Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer's film that I think is going to get Best Picture in his UK submission for international feature. On Wednesday, a little bit after 1:30 or so, I'm going to go see The Taste of Things, which is France's submission to the international feature category ahead of Justine Triet's Anatomy of a Fall. So, definitely excited to see if this is worth, kind of the controversy around that. And then Thursday, to wrap up my four-film festival, will be The Boy and the Hair and Hayao Miyazaki's newest film. Definitely looking forward to that one to cap it off. But yeah, I'm going to go ahead and, do a little bit of a live reaction. So if there's sound in the background, apologies for that. But after each movie, I'm going to go ahead and give my just honest gut reaction reviews, maybe on the ride home, maybe sitting somewhere after the movie. Before heading out, just to give you the on-the-ground feel of what it's like having seen the film. So, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and finish this burrito I just got so that I can make it to the theater in time. But, yeah, looking forward to chatting with you guys. If you hear that in the background, I'm on the bus. It's about 5:09 p.m. right after I saw Evil Does Not Exist by Ryusuke Hamaguchi at the New York Film Festival. Just getting my quick thoughts out of there. First off, I was in the Alice Tully Theater up on the balcony. Ryusuke Hamaguchi came out, introduced the film, said it was actually a project based on a request from the composer for Drive My Car, his most recent film, Eiko Isubashi, to make visuals for some, music she's working on. So then we hop into the film. Without getting too much into spoilers, it's not as long as Drive My Car, which is nearly 3-hour movie, but this one's just under 2 hours or so, and it's very meditative is the word, right? The opening shot is that of it's a very slow fluid tracking shot looking up at some trees in rural Japan in the winter, no leaves, music kind of hypnotic, frankly, right? Like, he described in the conversation with afterwards that it's a three-act structure. The first act, right, is about nature, and then this father-daughter relationship of the main character, Takumi, and his daughter, Hannah. I feel like for the first 5 to 10 minutes, there's, zero dialogue throughout. But it's just him, you see him cutting wood, or you see him collecting spring water, and it's just very slow and steady and almost Koganada-esque, right? I feel like I use that term a lot, but it just is a way to describe just how slow and paced and deliberate it all feels. The second act, without getting, again, too much into spoilers, kind of like the main conflict in the film is more or less a zoning development conflict, a movie about zoning development. But basically, this company in Tokyo wants to open a glamping site near this community of about 6,000 people. And it's essentially, this you know, this organization, this company comes in, they don't really understand the community and the impact that their graphic site would have on the community, say with the septic tanks or with potential campfires and so on. Apparently, this is actually based on a true story near the studio of Eiko Isibashi, where he went to get inspiration. There was a story about a similar company that came and did do a similar presentation to the community, and that got brutally panned for just being completely inadequate. And then, you know, it kind of sifts right a little bit to the perspective of the Tokyo folks as they, you know, I feel kind of sorry for them. They're kind of caught between their big boss, who doesn't really understand the situation. And, you know, he says, I guess the community session was a success. No, it wasn't, but everyone just laughed at that. And they're kind of caught between, you know, the demands of their boss and their people, and then just clearly understanding that this work will not be good for the community, right? And then I will say that the final scene, it ended very abruptly, and I'm still kind of processing exactly what happened in the ending. It's a bit of a shocker, kind of changes the tone of the film, and I think ties back to the central the title of the film, Evil Does Not Exist, which, you know, you don't really get throughout the film why that is, but I think it comes down to what it is, which I'm not going to give the spoiler here. I think I'll write it up more a little bit later for the quote on Kanju Zoom Pod. But yeah, definitely a great film. I was kind of like in my head judging, like, okay, give him the benefit of the doubt, sort of at a 4 out of 5. Looks like, you know, it kind of works there, but then kind of toward the end, and as it gets, these characters get fleshed out more, it becomes apparent that this is definitely a 5 out of 5 film for me. Definitely looking forward for other people to watch it. Actually, what I'm interested in is, so we've heard about Ryusuke Hamaguchi having a second film coming out this year called Gift. So that's actually the silent version of this film that will be debuting alongside Eiko Isibashi, who is, you know, performing this. I believe it's debuting at this film festival in Belgium, he said in the discussion, and so he'll be doing live accompaniment to this film. I think it's black and white. I have to double check that, but so it's essentially, right, like, it's a separate film, but it's one without where the music should become more central, which, you know, interestingly here, there wasn't a heavy use of score, and I think one of the interesting things here was, like, the editing of how it would cut off the music, or it would transition scenes very abruptly, right, and I that was very, you know, effective. And I think the biggest strength of this film is how it controls the pace, and you can get a sense of, like, the first act, the pace is very slow and deliberate, and then the pace gets a lot faster in the second act, and then it kind of looks a weird hybrid toward the end. Overall, definitely enjoyed the film. I also want to say, you know, shout out to Chris from the Academy of Death Racers Discord. You know, during the Q&A, I was I put up a picture of Yosuke Hamaguchi in the Discord, and Chris, you know, messaged, oh, hey, I'm here also. So we ended up meeting up afterwards, and then, yeah, we're going to go actually see. I was able to get in the queue ahead of him for tickets, so I was able to get an extra ticket for The Boy and the Heron on Thursday, so Chris will be joining me for that as well. So looking forward to seeing him then, and yeah, looking forward to seeing my next film on Monday. But yeah, so far, a good start to the New York Film Festival, my first New York Film Festival, and looking forward to covering the rest of it for you guys. It is Monday, October 9th, 2:58 p.m. I'm actually not recording this right at the Lincoln Center where the New York Film Festival takes place. So basically, my day was that I was planning on going to go see the 12 p.m. screening of The Zone of Interest, the UK submission for international feature, and also a potential Best Picture contender as well. Barely was able to make it in before the movie actually started, which was, you know, great to actually happen. And then, yeah, we just kind of hopped straight into Zone of Interest. After the film, you know, there was a Q&A with director, screenwriter John Jonathan Glazer, the two lead actors, the two leads who played Wendy, Hedwig and Rudolf Haas, notably Sandra Huller playing the wife, and then also one of the producers as well as the sound director as well, coordinator was in attendance for the Q&A. So, you know, obviously the premise of Zone of Interest is that essentially follows the life of Rudolf Haas and his family, Haas being infamous for being one of the Nazi Party members who essentially orchestrated and constructed Auschwitz, the concentration camp. And, you know, notably here, he essentially built his house with his family pretty much right next to the concentration camp. And it's kind of, you know, an adaptation of a novel of a similar name, which, you know, during the Q&A, Glazer definitely acknowledged that it kind of helped plant the seed for the film that he was making, but you know, it mostly served as a way for him to find other primary sources that would have been used for that novel, being used for his own research as well. And you know, obviously Holocaust films have been done to death, But there have even been some, I believe, from the Nazi perspective, right? So, you know, what really can be done more that hasn't really been done? And, you know, one of the things that this film really, I think, tries to portray is the banality of those who do evil, right? You know, there's always a risk when you do a film and your central characters are, you know, pretty much some of the most evil people known to history, you know, do you accidentally end up glamorizing them? Do you actually end up causing empathy, right? It'd be really easy to fall into the trap of portraying somebody, you know, with a perspective that causes you to have, oh, well, you know, they're just normal humans after all, right? And to some degree, if you weren't really paying attention, you might think that here, right? Like, it shows Rudolf Haas and his family, you know, having a garden, raising their kids, going on, you know, doing all the things a normal family does, right? And that's the film, as he described it in the Q&A, that's the film you see, right? But kind of like, obviously, the context of it is you're kind of realizing, like, okay, like, on one hand, it's a humanizing where it shows that they have a human side to them, but then on the flip side, it causes that to then be inhuman because, you know, the reason they had the sound director on stage was the fact that, you know, as they described in the Q&A, there's the film you see and then the film you hear, right? In my mind, you know, this isn't really being talked about right now for the Oscar race for best sound direction. It really, I think, should be in consideration because even as I'd go as far to say as, you know, compared to the Sound of Metal several years ago, which, you know, obviously won best sound because it ended up it used the sound or lack thereof to really tell the story of, you know, a deaf individual. Here this film used the sound as a soundscape, right? To you know, they were very conscious throughout the Q&A to mention, talk about, you know, the ethics of portraying a horror such as the Holocaust in film, right? And Glazer didn't feel like as if he were really qualified to do that, and so, you know, they didn't show the atrocity directly on screen per se, but it was definitely present and not forgotten, right? By the fact that there were the sounds throughout of you could hear the concentration camps just over the wall. So, you know, the fact that soundscape was there was definitely, I think, a very crucial and integral part of the film to really making this film have the impact that it does. I mean, the other part I would think about the film is the fact that there was, you know, the house itself, right? So one of the central parts is how this family has this house next to the concentration camp, and it actually turns out, you know, in the Q&A from the producer that, yeah, they actually went, they actually, you know, did the research and go all there, and they ended up filming it pretty much on location. They actually built the house from scratch, and the house itself was a character, I think, throughout the film. And, you know, apparently one of the more interesting bits from the Q&A was that, you know, the production design team, they grew that garden that the family had pretty much from scratch, right? They had a garden grown over the course of 4 months with all the flowers and everything, which was, you know, I think, again, as with the sound design, I think a really crucial part of making this film work. I think the directing, you know, putting all that together is top-notch. You know, there were a couple of scenes that, at first glance, I didn't really fully understand, particularly, you know, some scenes where it almost looks like they're doing heat vision, or it's like reverse black and white. You know, in the end, you know, I think from what I've talked to others, it seems that might be, you know, a case of the portraying, you know, some individuals who are contrary to what the Nazis were doing, which, you know, I think makes sense given kind of that. I'm not sure how much that particularly added to the film, or if that was fully necessary, perhaps. But otherwise, I think it was an amazing film. Definitely, you know, I would say probably 4 out of 5 stars. I think the, you know, somewhat lack of a true narrative per se, maybe holds it back. It's more like a character study, but not even like a full character study. So, you know, and the way it ended, you know, was very haunting to some degree. But I feel that they're also, for us, right, as individuals, not really wanting the closure of the of kind of knowing what these individuals did, getting, you know, their justice. And, you know, maybe that's kind of the point of the film, showing that, you know, evil, you know, kind of, the film I watched before this, right, was evil does not exist. This shows that, hey, evil does exist, and it can exist, like they said in the Q&A, not from people who we don't relate to, but people who we very much could potentially relate to, and that's the scary part of it. So perhaps not the most uplifting conclusion to the film, but I think one that's very important to be said. So, you know, overall, I'd probably give this, again, maybe four stars out of five. You know, I don't do half stars. If I did, it'd probably be a 4.5 out of 5, but, you know, definitely a worthy contender for the Oscars, and, you know, looking forward to seeing how it does over the course of the award season. Okay, so I went to watch the 1:45 p.m. screening of Le Pot au Feu, or The Taste of Things, as it's known in English, the French submission for the Oscars international category this year, and the winner of Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this year. And I'm just going to say, you know, if you don't, a pot au feu is a literally translates to pot over fire, which is basically the term of a dish of essentially boiled beef and vegetables. That's kind of emblematic of the French people, right? It's a peasant food. It can also, to some degree, be elevated as well. So it's symbolic of France to some degree. And if that doesn't cue you in that this is a film about food, then yeah, that's what this film is about. And unfortunately for me, when I rushed out, so I've been doing intermittent fasting. So I could only barely get, you know, my wife, we had a couple of leftover hot dogs. I was able to heat those up and put those down before I had to run out to the door to get to my screening. And so I haven't really had a chance to eat since then. And oh boy, that was a mistake, not coming fully prepared with a full stomach, especially since the people around me were eating popcorn. So I definitely smelt that throughout the screening as well. Yeah, I mean, Pot au Feu is, you know, again, a story about set in 1885. It's about, you know, this fine, fancy French gourmet who, you know, has a relationship with his, a relationship of sorts, right? It's not really ambiguous. It's pretty clear that they're into each other, and that they have definitely strong feelings for each other. But, you know, the core of their relationship really is that of master and cook, as they say so themselves, though that might be hiding some deeper layers to their relationship. But it's this gourmand and his cook of 20 years, and it's basically, right, most of the film is, you know, frankly, not a lot happens plot narratively wise, right? There's no real external pressure, there's no real internal pressure or conflict as well. It's, you know, again, very similar to a slice of life. Like a lot of, it seems like a lot of the films I've been watching this film festival kind of could, in some sense, fall into the slice of life category. Here, you know, the focus is very much on the cooking and the cooking techniques. You know, the very first, you know, maybe 30 minutes is basically just scenes of the cook putting together a elaborate meal for him and his friends, you know, with great renown. You know, he's obviously very well known by his friends. And I mean, if there's one reason to watch this, it is for the cinematics of the cooking sequences. You know, the loving, you know, you can tell, like, the loving care that was put into capturing, you know, the effort and so on that was put in that goes into each dish. Especially when you consider, right, they don't have the conveniences of modern technology, no electric ovens, no easy running water. They need to get the water from the well. You can definitely get the sense, and you know, even then, like, you know, they don't have thermometers, they don't have electric ovens where you can adjust the level of gas or heat being used. They have to use coal, right, to fire their ovens and so on. And yet they're still able to create such elaborate dishes. It's kind of astounding, right? And this is really a love letter to food. But more than that, it's a love letter to food and what it means. Food as a form of love, right? As a form of affection, as a form of pride, right? So as an art form, right? And, you know, if that's not quintessentially French, I don't really know what is. Yeah, this definitely made me hungry. So I think overall I would give this one probably like a 4 out of 5, right? I don't think there was really enough meat, ironically enough, to the plot of this. A little bit of a slow pace, a little bit stretched out of a meal, so to speak. But still, where where it signs brilliantly. And if you are someone who loves cooking, right, if you're someone who likes not even fancy food, but just like a well home cooked meal, I think this would be a film you would appreciate, if only for the food porn, if only, right, to watch those sequences of the cooking, right? I think that definitely comes in as something to really appreciate. So overall, 4 out of 5, maybe 5 out of 5 if you're a foodie. Just got out of watching The Boy and the Heron, Hayao Miyazaki's latest film. I'm actually joined by another fellow Death Racer from the AODR Discord. It's Chris.
Hey, how's everybody doing? We just came out of The Boy and the Heron screening. I thought it was absolutely great. What did you think?
Yeah, so for me, thinking about how I think this felt to some degree like a remix of a lot of his other stuff, right? Like, there are elements of Spirit of the Way, right? Kind of like an analog for the suit sprites, for example. There's definitely a reference to The Wind Rises and the plane stuff. Moving out to the countryside, right? Similar to Totoro, for example. And then just kind of this maximalist nature of this fantasy world going on with a house moving castle. That's kind of my very first gut instinct, where people said that it's kind of, I've seen other reviews say it feels a little bit like a remix, and I definitely got elements where he's definitely pulling from, obviously, Miyazaki is very much he pulls all of his different elements in, and this is something along those lines.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's definitely things from all of his movies into this one, which, honestly, I love a lot of his movies, possibly all of them, so that's not really a bad thing. Animation was absolutely gorgeous. So many just utterly breathtaking shots. I feel like this might be his most... There's a lot of really interesting imagery throughout. Kind of surrealist a little bit at a point where he's fading into stuff. I'm going to keep it super vague. There's a lot going on at all times. Sometimes it does become a bit too much. I think a rewatch would help with that. But yeah, another strong film from Miyazaki.
Yeah, I think there's I would call it a criticism per se, but one note is that, Spirit of the Way, for example, is a fairly straightforward plot. Even if a film like, say, Totoro or King's Delivery Service doesn't still have a plot, it still has very much vibes. This one, I think, started off with a bit of a plot, right? I would say it's not too much of a spoiler. It's kind of the premise that, the main character, Mario, his mother dies in the hospital fire in the very first scene, which, speaking of animation, the scenes of him running toward the hospital in the fire. In the first minute of the film, it's just animation wise, hot take, this is up there with Across the Spider-Verse this year in terms of animation quality. Might be a bit of a hot take, but that's just me. But then yeah, it's a little bit starts off about grief, right? His father, again, kind of somewhat of the setting the premise, they move out to the countryside, he, starts a relationship with his former sister-in-law, I guess, which I don't know if that's a cultural thing, maybe of the time, perhaps, but in any case, he doesn't really accept her as his mother, right? And that's kind of going into this fantasy world eventually, that is, I think, the premise of grief. It kind of loses that thread a little bit on into the film, but it does kind of tie it up to some degree toward the end. So it doesn't quite have as tight a narrative grasp to it, but definitely, I think vibes are definitely there.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the vibes. I don't know if I'd say it's a competition between Across the Spider-Verse in terms of animation quality, but it's definitely a beautiful, beautiful film. Sometimes it is, yes, too sprawling for its own good. Could have been a little tighter, could have been a little more focused, but everything else, Miyazaki, he knows what he's doing at this point in his career, and he crafts yet another great film.
Yeah, I mean, ironically enough, I don't know if this is just me thinking a little bit too hard about it, a little bit of his son's Tales of Earthsea, right, where it may be that one was... I think one of its flaws was it tried to do too much of the world building here. This one similarly tried to build a little bit too much of the world without really, I think, nailing that to some degree, but not to his fault. I think it's definitely just a lot of ideas. I will say, to its credit, we've heard that this is supposed to be Miyazaki's last film, which has already been debunked. He says he's coming back for another one. But originally, the concept was he wanted to leave something behind for his kid, which, with the idea of his mom passing and his grandson, and then the main character, Mario, having grief, I kind of get that sense of wanting to leave something and wanting, one of the themes kind of in the end is living in an imperfect world and trying to move forward with that, Obviously, Miyazaki's a pacifist, famously, right? Kind of thinking about all of the horrors of war and so on. This kind of ties into that. So I think there's definitely, bit of a stronger thematic element throughout than maybe some of his other films.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there's a lot to grab onto thematically. with the themes of him trying to accept his new mother, and then his relationship with the Heron, of course. And there's always so much going on that'll keep your mind occupied.
Yeah. Anything else that's kind of like gut feeling, gut check about this film for you, Chris?
I think we hit on all of it. Great animation. It's very sprawling, a lot to think about thematically, sometimes a little bit for its own good, a little too much, but just great stuff all around.
I mean, I'd rather have a more ambitious film that maybe doesn't quite hit the mark of ambitious film versus one that plays it safe and doesn't strive for those heights, which I think is, in animation, right, the fact that that's all hand-drawn, or mostly hand-drawn, if anything, is insane, right? So, I mean, it's not the best Miyazaki work of all time. He's not always going to top himself, right? I would firmly put it in the upper third of his films for me personally. I like it when he leans a little bit more into the maximalist, surreal, supernatural nature of things. So that's just me personally. People have said, it's a mixed bag of things. Mixed bag. A mixed Miyazaki film is still miles ahead of almost any other animation out there today.
Yeah, I would agree. I would say probably for me, it's probably in the middle, I would say, within his filmography. But again, in the middle of Miyazaki's filmography, it's still better than a lot of animated movies out there.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, obviously it's not officially a competition, but you know, in the Oscar race, it is to some degree a competition. That's been myself, Paulo, and Chris from the Oscars Death Race Discord giving our impressions review for Boy the Harem here at the 61st New York Film Festival. I'm going to go ahead and record something a little bit later for kind of like a wrap-up for this audio diary, but thanks for listening, everyone. So, you know, after the New York Film Festival, there's still a couple of days more to go in the fest, but unfortunately I'll be out of town. So, yeah, I just finished up writing my last couple of reviews for Dakota to put on the ContraZoom Pod website. Many thanks to him for putting all of my written reviews for the film fest up on his site. You can definitely go check them out there. Just wanted to give an overall recap of New York Film Festival. And, you know, it's kind of interesting thinking about it, how a lot of my films kind of related to each other some way, in a sense, right? Like, so for example, Evil Does Not Exist, The Zone of Everything, and to some degree, The Taste of Things, actually, all three of them kind of related in the sense that they were more or less slice of life films, right? And of course, you know, there's the connection between Taste of Things and Evil Does Not Exist, kind of talking about the art that goes into the craftwork of something, right? Specifically, you know, either just rural work in general, but specifically, right, like getting water to make soba noodles better in the countryside, and then kind of the craft of putting together the food there for putting together the food in Taste of Things. So, you know, really interesting to see, I think, in a film festival, to see all of these things together. I mean, it's definitely a great experience if you haven't been to your local film festival. Of course, I'm a little bit, you know, lucky I get to be in New York and kind of like one of the epicenters of film in the world. But, you know, if you've been to your local film festival or just any place where there are fellow film lovers out there, I would definitely encourage you to go check it out. Watching a film like that is a communal experience. You know, there were parts of the film which, you know, if I had been watching it by myself at home, where, you know, supposedly you're more free to react as you like at a film, I wouldn't have felt as moved to react in a certain way to a scene. Watching it either on my phone, right, or even on my larger TV in my living room. Hopefully this isn't the last time I get to cover the New York Film Festival for ContraZoom Pod. But yeah, thanks again to Dakota for having me do this audio diary for you guys. Thank you guys for listening. Check out my reviews over on the ContraZoom Pod website. And, you know, if you want to listen to me talk some more, aside from, I'm sure I'll be on more episodes of Dakota's podcast in the future, but I'm at the Oscars Death Race podcast for sure. And, you know, if I ever decide to start it up again, you know, hopefully soon, the Box Office Watch podcast and the Yet Another Anime podcast, all found on Spotify. I'm sure Dakota will link to those in the show notes. But yeah, thanks again, and happy film watching, everyone.
Thank you, Paulo, for the instant recaps. As mentioned before, check out the show notes or go to ContraZoomPod.com to see his full reviews. You can find links to Paulo's podcast in the show notes. Make sure you check out our website often, as we have plenty more film reviews coming as we are covering the Imaginative Film Festival that celebrates the best in indigenous cinema. This has been a That Shelf podcast. Visit thatshelf.com for more great film discourse. Follow the show on Instagram, Twitter, and Threads at ContraZoomPod. Did you see any films at this year's New York Film Festival? Send an email to ContraZoomPod@gmail.com. Thank you to Eric and Kevin Smale for the theme music and to Stephanie Pryor for the logo design. If you like to listen to podcasts on YouTube, we do post all episodes there as well. And if you really like the show, consider tipping us on Ko-fi. Thanks for checking us out. Thank you.